Welcome to the Kingdom Reformation Podcast with Glenn Blakeney. Here the fire of revival ignites hearts and fuels a supernatural move of God throughout the nations of the earth. Join us each week for prophetic insights, apostolic teaching, and powerful conversations that will equip you to live fully awakened in your kingdom purpose. This is more than a podcast. It's a movement. Learn more about us by visiting kingdomreformation.org. Now, let's dive into today's episode.
You know, when we talk about launching movements, movements that really transform cities and nations fulfilling the Great Commission, we often find ourselves looking for kind of like a blueprint.
Right.
And well, today we're taking a deep dive into history. We're going to explore the Wesleyan Revival and uncover some truly fascinating insights from Winfield Bevan's book, Marks of a Multiplying Movement.
Yeah.
And if you're hungry for more resources and training on this topic, you can head over to kingdomreformation.org. There's a treasure trove waiting for you there.
Yeah. I think it's amazing to think that what started as a small group of Oxford students in the 18th century grew to impact millions around the world.
It's pretty incredible.
It is. And Bevan's does a brilliant job of distilling those key factors, you know, those marks that made this movement so explosive.
Okay, so let's rewind at the beginning. I'm always intrigued by origin stories. John Wesley, the driving force behind the Methodist movement, he had quite a dramatic start to life, didn't he?
He did.
Literally plucked from a burning house as a child.
It's hard to imagine the impact that that must had on him. You know, his mother even described it as him being plucked from the burning. As if it was, you know, a divine intervention.
Wow.
But what's fascinating is how that early experience seems to foreshadow his life's work.
Right, like a sense of destiny, of being spared for a purpose. And then you've got his encounter with the Moravians, those German pietists who emphasize personal experience over dry ritual. I mean, their idea of instantaneous faith, that sudden overwhelming assurance of salvation, it was pretty radical for the time, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It challenged the prevailing religious climate of the time, which is often, you know, more focused on intellectual assent to doctrine than the inner witness of the spirit.
Right.
So this encounter really planted seeds in Wesley that would later blossom into a full-blown movement.
And that brings us to that famous heart strangely warmed experience at Aldersgate.
Yes.
I mean, to talk about a pivotal moment, it's almost like a lightning strike that ignited a fire within him.
Yeah. It's considered his evangelical conversion, a moment of profound personal transformation that Bevan's points to as the first mark of a multiplying movement. And what's interesting is that Wesley's experience resonated so strongly because it spoke to a deep longing for a more experiential faith.
So it's not just about having a good idea or a compelling message. It's about that fire in your bones, that authentic personal transformation that fuels a movement.
Exactly. And you see that in Wesley's relentless drive, his passion to share this newfound experience with others. It's as if he couldn't keep it to himself.
Right. And that's where things get really interesting, right? Because you've got Wesley, an ordained minister in the Church of England, preaching this message of personal salvation. But he's met with resistance. The establishment wasn't exactly thrilled with his approach, were they?
Not at all. His emphasis on, you know, inward religion, on a heartfelt conversion and the assurance of salvation was seen as too emotional, too enthusiastic by the established church. And remember, the Church of England at that time had a very structured hierarchy, with ordained ministers holding the authority to preach and administer sacraments. Lay people, no matter how devout, were limited in their roles.
So how did Wesley respond to this pushback? Did he just tone down his message, try to fit in with the status quo?
Actually, he took a bolder step, inspired by his friend, the evangelist George Whitefield, who was already preaching to huge crowds in open fields. Wesley embraced open-air preaching. This was a radical move, breaking free from the confines of traditional church buildings and reaching people directly.
So imagine this, Wesley out in the fields, preaching to thousands of people, bringing this message of personal salvation directly to the masses. What a powerful image. But I'm curious, did he just focus on preaching, or did he recognize the need for something more, something to nurture these new converts?
That's a great question. And that's where Wesley went beyond Whitefield. He realized that evangelism, while crucial, was just the first step. He needed a system for discipleship, a way to ground these new believers in their faith and equip them to grow.
And that's where the Methodist societies come in, right?
Exactly.
I've heard about these small group gatherings. What exactly were they like?
Well, they were revolutionary for their time. Imagine this. Small groups meeting regularly, focused on prayer, Bible study, accountability, and mutual encouragement.
Wow.
This was the birth of a system that would become central to Methodism's growth.
That's amazing. So Wesley, an ordained minister, recognized the power of lay leadership. He didn't try to do it all himself.
Exactly. And that's a crucial lesson for us today as we think about launching movements. Wesley didn't just empower lay leaders. He created a structure where their gifts and passions could flourish.
So it wasn't just about preaching a powerful message. It was about creating a system for discipleship and empowering others to lead.
And that combination, that synergy, is what truly set the stage for the explosive growth of Methodism. Mm. And this movement quickly began to spread, reaching beyond England's borders.
You're talking about those daring Methodist pioneers who crossed the Atlantic and planted the seeds of the movement in America.
Exactly. These weren't ordained ministers or theologians, but ordinary people driven by their faith and empowered by the Methodist system.
Okay, give me some names. Who are these fearless trailblazers?
Well, there's Robert Strawbridge, a layman who established the first Methodist society near Baltimore. And then you have Philip Embury, a carpenter, and Barbara Heck, known as the mother of American Methodism, who started a society in New York City.
Wow, talk about taking a leap of faith. These early American Methodists faced incredible challenges, didn't they? I mean, they were in a new land, far from the established structures of the Church of England.
Right.
And yet they persevered.
They did. And their stories are a testament to the power of a movement that empowers ordinary people to step into leadership roles.
That's right.
But let's not forget the man at the helm of it all. Wesley wasn't just a gifted preacher. He had a remarkable ability to recognize and nurture leadership in others.
So it wasn't just about his charisma or preaching abilities, but his skill in building a team, delegating, and empowering others to lead. That's what Bevins calls apostolic leadership, yeah. Right?
Exactly. Wesley identified key individuals like his brother Charles, a prolific hymn writer, Adam Clark, a brilliant biblical scholar, Thomas Coke, passionate about missions, and Francis Asbury, the tireless circuit rider who would become a key leader in the American Methodist movement.
Wow, what a diverse group of leaders, mm-hmm. each bringing their own unique gifts and passions to the movement.
And that's a crucial insight for us today as we think about launching movements. It's not just about finding one charismatic leader, but about building a team, recognizing and nurturing the gifts of those around us.
This is fascinating stuff. We've seen how Wesley's personal transformation, his focus on discipleship, and his willingness to empower lay leaders laid the foundation for an explosive movement.
And in the next part of our deep dive, we'll explore how this movement managed to not only survive, but thrive even after Wesley's death.
Stay tuned. We're about to uncover some key insights on how to build movements that outlast their founder and continue to impact the world for generations to come. Welcome back. We're in the midst of exploring how the Methodist movement, fueled by John Wesley's vision and those 10 marks outlined by Winfield Bevins, went from a small spark to a raging fire. And I think a question that often comes up when we talk about movements is sustainability. What happens when the founder, that driving force, is no longer around?
Yeah, it's a question that Wesley himself grappled with. He wasn't getting any younger, and he had witnessed the deaths of close friends and colleagues. He knew that he couldn't lead forever, and he didn't want to see the movement crumble without him.
So what did he do? Did he try to create a super rigid system, like a Wesleyan handbook with all the answers?
Yeah.
Or did he, like, handpick a successor, someone to kind of take the reins and keep things running exactly as he had done?
Surprisingly, neither. Wesley understood that movements are living things. They need to adapt and evolve, not be confined by rigid rules or the shadow of a single leader. So instead of trying to control every detail, he focused on establishing structures that would empower leadership and provide continuity.
Okay, so I'm all about practical takeaways.
Mm-hmm.
What do these structures actually look like?
Well, for starters, there was construction of New Chapel in London. It was more than just a building. It became the movement's headquarters, a central gathering place, and a symbol of permanence.
It's like planting a flag, declaring, we're here to stay. This isn't just a fleeting moment of enthusiasm. This is a movement with roots.
Exactly. But Wesley knew that it took more than bricks and mortar. He needed a legal framework to ensure the movement's future. So in 1784, he established the Deed of Declaration.
Hold on. Deed of Declaration. That sounds pretty official. Give us a layman's explanation. What was the significance of this document?
Think of it as setting the stage for the Methodist Conference, a governing body that would continue even without Wesley at the helm. It formally recognized a group of 100 preachers with the authority to appoint preachers, manage finances, essentially guide the direction of the movement.
So it wasn't about Wesley clinging to control. He was actually creating a system for shared leadership and decision-making. Pretty revolutionary for that time, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And this becomes even more crucial when we consider what was happening across the Atlantic. The American colonies had just won their independence, creating unique challenges for the Methodist movement there.
Right. They were no longer under the umbrella of the Church of England. Did that create a leadership vacuum for the American Methodists?
It did. Up until this point, they had relied on Anglican clergy for sacraments like baptism and communion. But with the separation from England, they needed a new solution, a way to operate independently.
So what did Wesley do? Did he just say, okay, you're on your own now, America. Good luck figuring it out.
He actually made a pretty bold move. He decided to ordain preachers for America himself, granting them the authority to administer sacraments.
Wow, that must have ruffled some feathers back in England. I mean, he was still an ordained minister in the Church of England. Wasn't this seen as stepping out of line?
It was certainly controversial, but it was also a pragmatic decision. Wesley recognized that the American Methodists needed to be self-governing, to have the authority to operate independently.
So he was willing to risk criticism and push boundaries to ensure the movement's survival and growth. That takes courage.
It does, and this decision led to a pivotal event, the Christmas Conference of 1784 in Baltimore. This gathering marked the formal organization of the Methodist Episcopal Church in America, with Francis Asbury, who I mentioned earlier, elected as superintendent alongside Thomas Coke.
It's incredible to think that in just a few decades, Methodism had gone from a small gathering of Oxford students to a thriving independent church in a newly formed nation. That speaks volumes about Wesley's vision and his commitment to building something that would last.
It does. He didn't just start a movement. He built a system that could replicate itself, adapt, and thrive in new contexts. This is what Bevins calls movements outlasting their founder. Mark #9 in action.
But outlasting the founder is one thing. But what about sustained growth? Could this movement maintain its momentum even after Wesley was gone?
That's what we'll explore next. And the numbers are pretty astounding.
Okay, now I'm really intrigued. Stay with us as we delve into the remarkable growth of Methodism after Wesley's death. Welcome back to our deep dive into the Wesleyan Revival. We've traced the movement from its fiery beginnings with John Wesley's personal transformation to the establishment of structures that ensured its survival beyond its founder. But now let's talk about impact. Did this movement just fade away after Wesley's death, or did it continue to grow?
Well, it's remarkable how this movement not only survived, but thrived after Wesley's death in 1791. By that time, Methodism boasted over 120,000 members across Britain and America. But that was just the beginning.
Okay, give some specifics. How much did it actually grow?
So within just a few years of Wesley's passing, American Methodism alone exploded to 200,000 members and over 4,000 preachers. By the mid-1800s, they were planting over 700 churches per year.
That's incredible. What fueled this incredible growth? Was it just momentum from Wesley's leadership, or were there other factors at play?
You know, those intentional disciple-making systems we discussed earlier, the societies, the class meetings, and the bands,
yeah,
they played a huge role. They created a culture of discipleship and leadership development that continued to multiply even without Wesley's direct oversight.
So it's like each new convert was plugged into this system of growth and accountability. Eventually, they were equipped to lead and disciple others. It's a self-replicating model.
Exactly. And let's not forget Wesley's emphasis on lay leadership. He wasn't afraid to empower ordinary people, men and women, to preach, teach, and lead. This created a vast network of leaders who could carry the torch forward.
We're seeing this convergence of factors, a clear vision, effective systems, and empowered leaders. It's a potent recipe for movement growth.
And that's precisely what Bevins highlights, as Mark #10 movements reproduce everything. It's not just about numerical growth. It's about a culture of multiplication where disciples, leaders, small groups, and even entire societies are constantly being reproduced.
Like that ripple effect we talked about earlier, spreading outward from that initial spark of Wesley's heart strangely warmed experience.
A perfect analogy. And it's a powerful reminder for us today. Movements don't just happen by accident. They require intentionality, structure, and a willingness to empower others.
This has been an amazing journey through history. But I know our listeners are eager to connect these historical insights to their own passion for launching movements today. What are some key takeaways we can glean from the Wesleyan Revival?
Well, first and foremost, we're reminded that movements start with personal transformation. Wesley's own experience wasn't just a feel-good story. It fueled his passion and drove his actions.
So before we launch websites, podcasts, and marketing campaigns, we need to be on fire ourselves, ignited by a genuine encounter with God.
Precisely. And that fire needs to be sustained by prayer, as Wesley demonstrated. He was a man of deep, consistent prayer, and that was the foundation of his leadership.
So it's not just about passion. It's about grounding that passion in prayer, seeking God's guidance every step of the way.
And as we move forward, we need to remember the power of empowering others. Wesley's willingness to release leadership, to trust ordinary people to preach, teach, and lead was revolutionary and remains a crucial lesson for us today.
It's about recognizing that we can't do it all ourselves. We need to identify, equip, and release those whom God has called to join us in this mission.
And as we build our teams, let's remember the importance of intentional disciple-making systems. The societies, class meetings, and bands weren't just random gatherings. They were designed to cultivate spiritual growth and leadership development.
So it's not just about bringing people together, but having a plan, a process for helping them grow in their faith and become equipped to lead and disciple others.
And let's not neglect the importance of a holistic vision. Wesley wasn't just concerned about saving souls. He was passionate about addressing social injustices and promoting education. True transformation impacts every sphere of life.
So we need to see the big picture, understanding that the gospel has implications for every aspect of our lives and communities.
Finally, we must remember that lasting movements outlive their founder. They reproduce everything. Disciples, leaders, systems, and values, ensuring that the impact continues to ripple outward for generations.
It's a challenging but inspiring vision. And it reminds us that we don't have to be a Wesley to spark a movement.
Exactly. We just need to be faithful, obedient, and willing to follow where God leads.
Well said.
Yeah.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a question to ponder. What elements of the Wesleyan movement resonate most with you? And how can you apply those principles in your context, in your sphere of influence? Remember, for more resources on launching movements that transform cities and nations, fulfilling the Great Commission, check out kingdomreformation.org. There you'll find podcasts, training, and a wealth of resources to equip you on your movement-making journey. Thanks for joining us.
Are you passionate about Kingdom Reformation? Join the Kingdom Reformation Leaders Community, a global network of apostolic and prophetic voices, advancing revival in the church and reformation in every sphere of society. With your free subscription, you'll access valuable resources, upgrade to unlock exclusive content, plus our monthly live Zoom sessions featuring global kingdom leaders and interactive roundtable discussions that equip you to apply fivefold ministry and apostolic strategy in real time. Don't just watch revival, be part of reformation. Sign up today at kingdomreformation.org and take your place in the movement.